Welcome to the U.S. Law Essentials Law and Language Podcast, the legal English podcast for non-native English speakers that helps you improve your English listening, improve your legal English vocabulary, and build your knowledge of American legal culture.
Welcome to U.S. Law Essentials Law and Language Podcast. I'm your host, Stephen Horowitz. Today's episode continues our series of interviews with multilingual lawyers and law school professionals. Today's guest is George Alessandrados, a litigation associate at Keene & Bean PC in Westchester County, New York. George is a graduate of St. John's Law School in New York City. And George, I know because he was my teaching assistant when I taught legal writing for LLM students at St. John's. So now George is part of the working world, and I'm really, really glad and honored to have him here. George, welcome.
Hey, Professor. How's it going? Thank you for having me. Really looking forward to this. We haven't spoken, you know, we haven't seen each other nor spoken in a little while in person, you know. COVID happened and all that, and I graduated almost over a year ago, which is pretty crazy to me. So it's good to be here. Good to interact again.
Yeah, nice to see you. And I know you've got a couple of stories about working and doing stuff during the COVID. So Before we get to that, I gotta ask you. I like to start sometimes with a dad joke. Mm-hmm. Are you a fan of dad jokes?
I my friends are huge fans of them. I'm hit or miss with them. You know, I remember you used to do some of these in class too, and people would look at me for answers, and I'd be like, guys, I have zero clue. We'll try.
Okay. Let's see. Okay, here's the question. What did the police officer say to his belly button? What did the police officer say to his belly button?
Okay. I'm trying to think, but
we'll come back to it. Don't worry. This isn't going to work against your grade or anything.
Yeah.
Okay. So, first question I want to ask you is, have you ever lived in another country other than the US?
I have not. I haven't lived in another country physically. Mentally, I have, based on, you know, what's going on around me with languages and family and culture and stuff like that, but always lived in New York.
Oh, so say more about that.
So I'm Greek. You know, my father was born in Greece. He came to America about 30 years ago now. My mother was born in Utah, but her parents were born in Greece, so they also straight off the boat. So growing up, Greek was my primary language. You know, I speak English to my mom, but I speak Greek to my father. I spoke Greek to my grandparents. I speak Greek to basically all my family and my friends. And one thing about being Greek, you're very proud to be Greek. So growing up, you have to know the language. You have to go to Greek school and you have to go to church and stuff like that. And I think a lot of people start off doing that and then it tailors off as they get older. I was lucky enough that, you know, I went to the Greek schools for a few years and I spoke to my father every day in Greek and I watch Greek TV and I read Greek news and I watch Greek sports and stuff like that. And I think with language, it's something that if you do every day, it's great. If you don't do it for a little while, you forget it. So I just was surrounded by the culture and I felt, you know, growing up Greek, that's how I grew up.
Let me ask you another question. I like to ask people who, whenever I talk to somebody who grows up bilingually or biculturally, If you do math in your head, what language do you do the math in?
It depends on the numbers, actually. You know,
really?
I'll do the math in English most of the time, but increments of five, I'll oftentimes repeat in Greek, you know, like 5, 10, 15, 20, 25. If I'm doing something like that, I'll sometimes say it in Greek because growing up, when we played hide and seek in Greece on vacation, we would always count, it would be up to a huge number in increments of five. So you learn how to say it really, really quickly. And now that just clicked in my head. So in my head, I just repeat that like long blurb of numbers. And yeah.
What does that sound like when you count really fast by fives in Greek?
In Greek, it's 5, 10, 15, 20, 25, 30, 40, 50, 60, 70, 80, 90, and it keeps going and going and going. And I just got up to 55 there. But like, that's how we cheated in hide and seek, and that's how like I'll remember sometimes, you know.
Oh, interesting. So math you did primarily in English because you were in school in the U.S. Yeah. and doing math in English, but that one number usage that was very frequent and that you did very quickly is something that always stuck with you in Greek. Interesting.
Yeah. Almost. Yeah. Yeah, yeah, for sure. And it's not only, you know, I mean, oftentimes too, and it's not only with numbers, it's with words too, where I'll know words in Greek that I don't know in English, and I'm trying to translate them in my head. And I'm like, guys, I don't know how to say this in English. And people are like, how do you not know how to say, like, it's a basic word, but I don't register. Cause sometimes too, depending who I'm speaking to or what I'm speaking about, you know, it's always, people always ask me, do you think in Greek or do you think in English? And it really depends on the context and who I'm speaking to and what I'm speaking about.
And are you aware when you're thinking in Greek versus English, or is it almost like it's not even on your radar screen?
I only become aware of it when I'm struggling to put out the word in English and people are probably looking at me like, why are you paused for like a minute now? And then it's always, oh man, I don't know how to say it in English. And then people are like, what are you doing? Like, what do you mean you don't know how to say it in English? You know, but it's, you know, a lot of people might not know that I'm also bilingual and all that stuff.
And do you dream? What language do you dream in more frequently?
That's probably English. Yeah. But it depends too. If you know, if I'm dreaming I'm in Greece, I'm dreaming in Greek, you know?
And you've been to Greece before, I assume.
Yeah. Yeah. Growing up, I would go every single summer because that's one of the things when you're growing up Greek in America, especially for the first generations. And I don't know if I'm first generation, I'm first and a half generation. I don't know what the definition is. I consider myself first generation, and it's big that you have to know the culture and you have to know the country and you have to be proud and know the history. And it's like a rite of passage going to Greece in the summer. And I had family there, you know, because my dad came straight to America. So my family was there. My grandparents and stuff. So it was a chance to go see them, but also a chance to go see where you're from. And, you know, so I used to go every year, then college started and I couldn't go every summer. So I went in 2017 at the end of college. I went in 2019 entering my 3L year of law school. And coincidentally, as of a few days ago, I'm also going this August with some of my friends. So it's good to go back home, so to speak.
And the best Greek food in New York City?
Anywhere in Astoria. You want to get Greek food, you go to Astoria. That's
Astoria, the neighborhood in Queens, you mean, right?
Yeah, yeah, Astoria, yeah. Queens. You know, there's good restaurants in Manhattan and Long Island and stuff like that. But if you want that authentic experience where you know, it's not the prim and proper linen napkin experience, you go to Astoria.
Got it. Okay, so now let's ask you a little bit about your work. This is you started this past year during the pandemic, yeah. Working as a litigation associate at Keenan Bean. And actually, before we even get to that, before you started working there, you had to pass the bar exam, right? Tell us what happened with the bar exam this year during the pandemic.
Yeah, no one really knows what happened, right? I tried to keep track of it as much as possible. But basically, you know, the bar exam is always the last Tuesday and Wednesday of July, right? And then they also do it in February. But as a JD student, you're taking it in July, you know, absent any unexpected circumstances. So that was supposed to be July 29th and 30th or something like that. COVID happens around March 10th or whenever the beginning of this, you know, shutdown happened. And we got an email and it's like, okay, the bar exam is canceled for now. Something like that. I don't really remember. And we're like, okay, what's going on? Then we got an email 2 months later and it's like, okay, the bar exam is going to be in September. Or yeah, I think it was September, beginning of September. And we're like, all right, well, now we're going to prep for this. Fantastic. So you start prepping and no one really knew what to do, right? Because people typically start studying for the bar exam either right after graduation or a little before. So it's like, you know, end of April, May time, but that's for a July bar exam. So now in September, I'm like, well, what do I do? You know, I don't want to burn myself out, but I don't want to just think like, oh, now I have extra time. long story short, I started prepping probably like July, I would say. I was trying to go on that 10-week schedule that is pretty typical for bar prep. I'm studying, and about 2 weeks in, mid-July, we get another email. And they're like, yeah, we're canceling the bar exam because COVID's not letting it happen. We're like, okay, well, this is the second time it's being canceled. When is it going to be this time? They said, until further notice, we don't know. So we didn't know what to do. Our bar prep companies didn't know what to do. So they're sending out emails like, guys, this is completely new. Just take a break right now. You know, you're going through a lot of stress. St. John's even sent out an email and they were like, guys, you should probably just not study for a few days or take a week off. Just, you know, relax a little because everyone's in limbo. And I don't know if it was a week later or 2 weeks later. And they said, okay, it's going to be in October, but it's going to be online. And online was through the software that we actually use at St. John's. It was Exemplify. And
that's the software that
yeah, that's the software, ExamSoft.
They make you put it on your computer so that you can't, so while you're taking an exam, you can't access any other apps or programs or the internet or anything like that, right?
Absolutely, yeah. They lock you out of everything. And when we were in law school, they didn't have the camera on. For this one, they had the camera on and they were recording you. And they said, you know, if there's sounds, it will be flagged by the AI, the artificial intelligence, the computer. And then we'll have, you know, real people go and review it and see, you know, were you looking away from your computer? Were there indications of you cheating? You know, this, that, and the other. So that got a lot of people nervous.
Oh, yeah. I think I remember hearing stories of people who were flagged or cited and told that they had failed the bar. They had to stop taking the bar because there was some sound that got picked up, even though they really hadn't done anything.
Yeah, I don't know if it was in live time. I know that, you know, my biggest concern, because people were trying to take practice exams and in other states too, because it was a UBE thing, you know, the Uniform Bar Exam. Yeah, in multiple states, we were all going through the same thing. So social media really became a place where you could go and see what other people are doing and what other people are going through. And they're like, yeah, you know, every time I try to take a practice exam, my computer crashes. And what am I supposed to do if this happens on the day of the exam? And so there was a lot of panic on that. And we were the first group to take it, a remote exam, a remote bar exam, on technology that it was not tried and tested on for the actual bar exam. So my biggest concern was twofold. One, let me finish the exam. I knew that, you know, if I'm going to fail the exam, let me fail on my own, not because my computer didn't work and the software didn't want to work. And two, I didn't want any noise or anything to disqualify me. I didn't think that was, you know, that was fair. And to be fair, I was lucky enough where I was in a quiet space and stuff like that. But I know other people and friends of mine too. They were in, you know, in a small apartment or something, and they had a roommate working from home at the time. And what are they supposed to do? Or they had an animal, or they had plenty of people have kids and they have to take care of their kids, or they have, you know, a lot of people were sick and they needed a break and they needed accommodations that in person you can get and online you cannot. And so that was a big thing. Again, I'm lucky enough that I didn't have to deal with that, but a lot of people did. And that was just unfortunate because I don't know, you know, I was reading online that accommodations weren't being granted, or they were being granted last second, or they were being half granted and stuff like that. So it was really weird for us. And, you know, to be fair, we did only take technically half the exam. They cut the exam straight in half. Because we were the first people, they had no clue if, you know, it's two long essays. I forget what they're called. MEE or something. And then there's six shorter essays normally, and then 200 multiple choice. I think the MEE are the six shorter ones and the two longer ones are MPT, something like that. One of those, and 200 multiple choice. But for us, because I think partially because we were the first group to take it, even though some companies didn't want to admit it, they had no clue it was going to work, I think they said, let's cut it down because there's a lot of data going on here. We don't know if this is going to work. And the other thing that they did was, and I don't know if they're still doing it this way, everyone taking the exam started at the same time. So that means we were on the same time as Hawaii. Hawaii, if we were starting 9 a.m. on the East Coast, Hawaii, they're starting at like 3 a.m. or 4 a.m. I don't know what the time
is. Wow.
Yeah. So,
I did not know about that. That is crazy.
There was no way for us to put in those long hours on the East Coast without going into the night. And there was no way for them to do it on the West Coast without starting from, you know, 4 a.m. So,
right, because what time did the test? So you started at 9 a.m. What time did it end?
Well, I started at 12. I started at noon because we're in New York, so that California could start at 9 a.m.
Oh, before we move on, any advice you would have for future bar takers?
Absolutely. And I say this to people that are taking it now. I say this to 1Ls. I say it to 2Ls. This was a piece of advice I got, and it really stuck with me. It's that this is not the hardest thing you're going to do. That's what really I repeated to myself while studying. It's not the hardest thing we have to do. It's an exam. We've taken plenty of exams so far. We've been in school for many, many years. We know how to take exams. Granted, this one might have slightly more importance to it, and granted, it might have slightly more, you know, anticipation behind it because you've been working for it for 3 years in law school for this one moment. Is not the hardest thing you're going to do. You know, have faith in yourself. You know what works for you. This is what I tell people all the time. You know what works for you in terms of study habits, in terms of testing habits. It's not the time to change it. And that's what I stuck to myself. At first, I was like, you know, I'm going to do flashcards. I'm going to do this. I'm going to do that. I never did those growing up. I never did those through law school either. And I opened a pack of flashcards. And after I saw the first flashcard, I was like, nope, this is not happening. And I stuck to what I know works. It worked for me this far. I had faith that it would work for me again one last time on possibly the last exam I'll ever take. So
what worked for you?
You know, I took Barbary. I took Barbary as the bar prep company. And I think other companies do this too. They have a progress meter. They say where you should be every day. I started a month after everyone, so it said I should have been 20 or 25% of the way through. I know what works for me. I know that I can catch up because I will put in the hours and I will put in the work and I'll know where I can cut corners a little bit, whether it's a subject I know or whether, you know, I'm not too concerned about the MPTs, for example. I know my strengths. I play to that. I knew that if I start panicking, that's going to not be good for myself. So I tried not to panic. It's very difficult. During the exam, it happened. But I just had faith in myself. I know that I'm a sit down, you know, get my things together and put in work for the next 8 to 10 hours and then on to the next day. You know, it wasn't I wasn't as structured as necessarily the bar courses or even, you know, professors would suggest. But I never did do that, even in law school. I knew what worked for me, and I just stuck to it.
Okay, so it sounds like that served you well. So you finished the bar, you passed, fortunately, and now you're working at this law firm. How do you describe what you do to, say, a grandmother or your, you know, aunts or uncles who ask about it, or perhaps some younger nephews or nieces?
Yeah. So I start off with saying I do a little bit of everything. You know, as you said earlier, it's a general litigation position. So it's all litigation. I don't really do any transactional work first and foremost. But where I'm at.
So that means you're suing people? You're in court all day?
I haven't gone to court yet. But yeah, that's what the people around me are doing. Yeah, they're not doing, like, you know, wills and trusts and contract drafting and stuff like that. These are the people that you would see on TV, so to speak, except we don't do criminal law. But, you know, maybe if it's a civil case on TV, never on TV because it's not as juicy, but, you know, that kind of stuff. So in terms of litigation, we don't do personal injury, we don't do criminal, but we do a little bit of everything else. My website profile says I do environmental law, and it says I do land use and zoning, and it says I do general litigation. And I think the most accurate one is general litigation, because it's not only environmental, it's not only land use. But what do I do? How would I explain it to someone? Whatever you could think of happens. Breach of contract, we've worked on. You know, environmental compliance, regulatory compliance stuff, I've worked on. A lot of our clients are municipalities, cities, towns, villages, Westchester County area and north. And when you work with municipalities, you're sort of, you know, there's a whole wide variety of issues that come up every
when you
day.
Say, when you say municipalities, you mean like the towns, the yeah. town governments. There's a lot of small towns in, yes. in New York City.
Yes.
Or just above, sorry, in Westchester County above New York City.
Yeah.
There's county government, there's town government, but not, yeah. not you don't mean state government, right?
No, we do. We represent towns, specifically towns, villages, cities, mm-hmm. and, you know, things that come up. And whether that's advising on, you know, applicability of a contract or something like that, or whether there's a land dispute or an easement with, you know, that the town has or is granting or something like that, it really runs the mill. It could be anything.
So are you drafting complaints? Are you doing legal research? Are you
a little bit of everything again?
Emails?
A little bit of everything again. I was at work today drafting a complaint. It's mostly legal research because I just started, and that's actually something that I always tell people in law school. That is something that if you could get good at, there is a market for that. There yeah. It's really important to be good at researching. I'm not saying I'm good. I hope I'm good. I hope I'm good enough. But, you know, legal research, a lot of it. Interactions with clients. It's weird now because of the pandemic, right? Like I don't really quite know what the norm is because I just started working. And I don't know what the norm is because I also started working at a time where nothing is normal.
Right.
So, there's that. But it'll be drafting parts of a brief maybe, or, you know, sometimes take a stab at drafting the entirety of one. It really depends. It really depends on the case and my availability and the availability and the time frame that we have to work with. Right.
So what are some of the tasks you did at work today, for example?
So today I drafted a summons and complaint. I reviewed a contract, to see if there's a certain provision in there that calls for allocation of spending, not allocation of spending, but whether a certain party has to pay for something. What else did I do today? I did the contract. I did the summons and complaint. I worked on drafting a letter to a town board regarding a land use application. You know,
a land use. Can you say more about what a land use application?
Yeah, land use application. You know, that's one of the things on my website profile. Land use and zoning is that, you know, if someone comes and says, "Hey, I want to do this on my property, but the town code says I need X number of square feet to do it, and I only have Y number of square feet, which is less than X. How do I go about this?" And what you would have to do in most situations is you seek for a variance, which is a variance is just, you know, the town saying, okay, I know that you have less than the required square feet, but we'll let you do it under these conditions or whatever. So you have to file an application. And a lot of town codes or village codes or city codes describe what the application process is and what you have to show and all that. So today I was drafting this letter and I found the town code that says, these 8 factors are going to be considered. So what did I do? I put it in the letter and I said, all right, addressing factor number 1. Here's why, you know, our client should be granted the special permit. Here's number 2. Here's why they should be granted the special permit. So that's what the land use kind of stuff is. Building permits, variances, site plan approval waivers, stuff like that. It all sounds, you know, very complex, but it's really everything that you would expect. You can't just go somewhere and just build, right? You need permits. And that's where you hire attorneys most of the time to handle this for you.
What are some aspects of your legal practice that you like or that you enjoy?
I certainly like the land use stuff that I like. I mean, I'm not saying I only enjoy land use. I want to make that clear, but I can sort of relate to it. I took a construction law course at St. John's, for example, because my father's an architect and my brother's an architect. And I've always been around construction growing up. I've always been around renovations and projects like that. My dad would take me to job sites. So now seeing the transactional aspect of it, the building permits and the waivers and variances and stuff like that before you get to construction, that's interesting to me. You know, And I think that I've also been lucky enough to work on some pretty interesting cases so far. You know, not necessarily, again, on TV, all they show are criminal cases, right? Like murders and stuff like that, and terrorism mm-hmm. plots and stuff. But the civil aspect has some interesting things in it where you sort of see, like, you learn new things. You learn new things. You know, there's not necessarily a run-of-the-mill case, and being able to learn these new things, I think, is pretty cool. I think it makes you, you know, more well-versed, because you come out of this and you're like, hey, trivia night, I learned something by working on this case, and now I'm gonna get this question right, and no one else is gonna know it. I know it because I spent, you know, 8 hours reading into it or something like that. So
you really build up a lot of background knowledge and cultural knowledge.
And you don't even notice that you're doing it until you're having a conversation with someone, you know, with your friends on a weekend, and they bring up something and you're like, well, actually it's this way. And they're like, how do you know this? And it's like, you wouldn't believe this, but it came up the other week at work.
And what are the fringe benefits of practicing law?
Yeah. Yeah.
Would you be able to write a legal document in Greek, or is that a whole different skill set?
That is a whole different, entirely different skill set. And it's funny you ask that, because my grandmother, she's been on me for the last few weeks. I just came back from seeing her over the weekend. I visited her in Utah for her birthday. She's been on me to translate her will from Greek into English. And I'm like, all right, I could do this. And she writes in Greek, like a, it's called katharevousa. It's like not ancient Greek, but it's like a legal Greek, so to speak. And this is just like a sort of different language. It's like a different dialect.
In the movie My Big Fat Greek Wedding, accurate or or not?
You know, growing up, I always got that question. It was, and you know, I went to Greek school. Greek school being daily Greek school, where you had Greek classes every day and Greek history and stuff until fourth grade. Fifth grade, I started going to quote unquote American school. And that's where people were like, fifth grade, it was probably for me 2005, 2006. So My Big Fat Greek Wedding, I think, came out around then, or maybe a little before then. So a lot of people were like, oh, you're Greek, you know, My Big Fat Greek Wedding, this, that, Windex, this, that, and the other. And I still hear it to this day. But what I remember growing up, I was like, man, these Americans, they don't get it. Like, it's not like this. This movie really put out a bad name. But then I watched it a few years ago, and I was like, you know, this is obviously hyperbole, but some of the underlying parts of this are sort of accurate. Like, you know, we don't necessarily spray Windex on everything, but the underlying aspect of, like, my father is obsessed with, like, baby wipes, for example. We always have to have baby wipes everywhere. You know, anything that spills can be cleaned by baby wipe. If you get oil on you, baby wipe. You spill wine on you, baby wipe. You should have baby wipes in the car, things like that. So that kind of stuff is accurate. And the whole, like, you know, what do you mean you don't eat meat? It's okay, I'll make lamb. Like, that kind of stuff, again, sort of accurate, because it's like, you don't really hear people say, you know, to a Greek party, for example, yeah, I don't eat meat, because Greeks eat a lot of meat. The diet is heavily, you know, meat based and stuff like that. So, you know, it's almost like cuisine, especially, for example, my grandmother, she'll offer people food. And I think this was like this in the movie. She'll offer people food even if she just met them. The mailman comes by, why don't you come in and have some food? You know, someone came to fix the sprinklers, come in, I have food ready for you. And I think the movie does a good job of showing that. And it's almost like disrespectful if you say no, right? So some of it is, the underlying tones are accurate, and they had an hour and a half to get this out there. So, you know, it was hyperbole at some points, but looking back at it, there are certain things that
fits with an experience I had years ago in Ohio. We were visiting a friend who was from there, and we went over to visit his brother, and his brother's wife is Greek American, and they happened to be having a lamb roast, I guess. They were roasting an entire lamb in their backyard. And people were, all these people were coming over, and they just invited us right in. They didn't know us, but they started giving us food. And I guess I didn't know at the time that that's sort of how it is.
Yeah, my friends love it. A lot of my friends are Greek or Italian, and Italians are like Greeks, you know, similar. There's the saying, una faccia, una razza, one face, one race. You know, we look the same, we're the same culture, all that stuff. I jokingly tell my friends that Italy is Western Greece too, so they love when I say stuff like that. But, you know, and if they hear this, they're going to laugh when they hear that part. But no, it's really, I remember back in high school, I brought some of my friends, and my friends from high school weren't Greek, and I brought them to a Greek social club that my dad was the president of. And that night it was just, you know, food and wine and soda and all this and music. And one of them was like, do you guys do this every week? And I'm like, yeah, we pretty much do this every week. Like, this is how it is. They're like, this is so cool. I'm like, yeah, you say that now, but then you get tired of it.
Well, George, thank you so much. It's been really a treat getting to talk to you. Before we finish, I wanted to ask if you have any advice that you've been given in your life that you'd want to share, or maybe advice that you like to give to other people, law students or lawyers.
Yeah, for sure. So the one thing I touched on earlier was, for the bar exam, this isn't the hardest thing you're ever going to do. And that applies for law school. That's not the hardest thing you're ever going to do. And that applies to applying for jobs. That's not the hardest thing you're ever going to do. And that applies to working. It's not the hardest thing you're going to ever do. That's one piece of advice. My second piece of advice, and I've noticed this, you know, over the years, I grew up playing soccer. And one of the things I was told back then, and, you know, professional soccer players say, commentators say, coaches say, it is that the game is 90% mental. And I think that I gave this advice when I TA'd with you. I gave the advice to a lot of the students, because the students were coming from abroad and they were new to America, or they've been here, but they were new to this program. And they're like, I can't do this. I don't know how to use a computer. I don't know how to speak the language. I'm doomed. I'm like, guys, it's 90% mental. And to tie into that, my sub piece of advice on that is always go out. I told them, go out, live your life, spend time with your families, enjoy your weekends, enjoy your nights. Because if you don't have the mental clarity, everything is so much more difficult, whether it's prepping for the bar, whether it's doing work for school, whether it's going to class, whether it's working in an office, working in whatever situation. You need to have that mental clarity. You need to have that mental positivity, and you need that downtime to just unwind, because school gets on you. Work gets on you. Bar prep gets on you. And the more you hold it in, eventually you're just going to shut down. You're going to burn out. So my single biggest piece of advice, and this applies not only to the legal world, to everything. Remember, it's 90% mental. Take care of yourself. And, you know, mental health is a big thing now. And I don't want to, you know, make this about mental health, but it's a problem that a lot of people are dealing with, especially now with COVID and being inside and all that stuff. You have to take care of yourself. Take care of yourself first and foremost, and everything else will be much better. If you're not taking care of your body, if you're not taking care of your mind, work is harder, school is harder, bar prep is harder, life is harder. So my biggest piece of advice, one day at a time, focus on yourself. Do what you enjoy. If you're having fun doing it, you're going to love it. If you're miserable doing it, it's not going to last long. It's going to burn you out.
Yeah, and that seems like something that the legal profession and the law school world have started to take a lot more seriously and are really focusing on. And I think that's a really important.
Yeah, and I hope so. And I know, for example, I have friends that are taking the bar exam this summer, or took it over the winter, are going to take it next year. And they're always like, you know, I have to study, I'm so far behind. And this is what I referred to earlier with the progress meter on Barbary. Don't worry about what you should be doing, right? Focus one day at a time. You can't change the past. And importantly, and I told my friends too, if you're studying for the bar, the first month, the first few weeks, I knew what worked for me. I went out on weekends. I suggest people go out on weekends, unwind. You can't let this take over your life. And I'm not saying go out and then come home at 4 a.m. on a Sunday because it's summer and then, you know, have to wake up. Oh, I'll wake up at 2 p.m. on Monday and I'll study. No, go out with your friends. Have that connection. Speak to your family. Watch a movie. Do things like that. That is so important. So, so important for everything, you know, for work. First, I can't stress it enough. That's definitely my biggest piece of advice.
Thanks, George. And now we get to come back to the dad joke. Let's see if any of this has tripped some wires in your brain that bring an answer to your lips. Okay. What did the police officer say to his belly button? Any new thoughts?
Absolutely none. I'm going to go with you're under arrest, but that probably doesn't make sense. I want to say it's you're under something.
You almost got it. It's you're under a vest.
Oh, man. I was really under arrest.
You're under a vest.
Right? Oh, man.
Belly button is under the vest. So anyway, thank you, George, so much for being here. This is a really unique and interesting interview and of course, a great chance to catch up as well.
No, and thank you for having me. I definitely loved catching up. Time flew by. I didn't even realize how long we've been talking, but it's just great. It's great to interact with people that I've worked with in the past or I've seen in law school. It's nice. So I appreciate it. I appreciate being able to speak to you about this. I hope people can hear this and maybe it can help one person, two people, however many it helps. So thank you very much for the opportunity. I'm very appreciative.
Okay. And I have a feeling we're going to be checking back with you at some point to see, you know, to hear more about how things are going and experiences as well as evolutions in Greek culture.
You let me know and I am available. Right. I am available.
Okay. So thanks everybody for listening to US Law Essentials Law and Language Podcast and stay essential.
Hi, and this is Daniel Edelson. Thank you to Steve and George for this great episode. Remember, if you have questions or comments or suggestions for future episodes, please contact me at daniel@uslawessentials.com. And please follow us on Facebook and on LinkedIn.